From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. David Bigler's been called a revisionist historian, and the people who have called him that didn't mean it in a good way. His work has challenged some of the conventional ideas of Utah history, particularly the stories of the early Mormons who settled this place. That's where the label came from. But Bigler embraces the term. He owns it. Because, as he has said, if ever there was a chapter of history that needed revising, it's this period. Today in the program, Bigler is joining us to talk about the history he's been revising all his life. The historian Will Bagley, a longtime collaborator with Bigler, is also joining us. And our conversation comes with the news that two mass grave sites from the Mountain Meadows Massacre in 1857 have been discovered. So we'll talk about that too. Join us after the news.
Hey, I'm Elaine Clark, one of the producers for Radio West, inviting you to check out Video West. It's our online showcase of short documentaries about the places and people that make Utah what it is. You can stream the films at videowest.kuer.org, and if you like what you see and hear, we hope you'll share it with your friends. And thanks!
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're going to have with us the historians David Bigler and Will Bagley. Bigler's just published a collection of essays and articles about some of the subjects he's investigated and explored over the years. A lot of this work is focused on 19th century Mormonism, particularly the leadership of Brigham Young and his influence on the people and events of this part of the West. Bigler has spent his share of time on the mass murder of more than 120 people in a wagon train headed for California in 1857. They were killed by Mormon settlers in what is now southern Utah in an incident that's come to be known as the Mountain Meadows Massacre. And we'll be talking about that with Bigler and with Will Bagley a little bit later on the program. But this is also where we're going to begin, because this past Saturday in Harrison, Arkansas, an archaeologist named Everett Bassett told a group of descendants of the people killed in 1857 that he had discovered two large mass graves of the victims at Mountain Meadows. There's always been some question of where those mass graves were in that area. Bassett had been using U.S. Army records from the time. He was sitting on a pile of boulders when he realized they were part of a burial chamber. Everett Bassett is joining us now. He's a senior archaeologist with the California-based consulting firm TransCon Environmental. And he presented his findings, as I said, to the Mountain Meadows Association on Saturday. He's joining us by phone from California. And Everett Bassett, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks, Doug. Glad to be there.
So could you just give us a sense? This is how you were quoted in the Arkansas Democrat Gazette as saying that when you realized this was part of a burial chamber, you were sitting on this big pile of rubble of rocks, and it was like getting hit in the stomach. Would you give us a sense of the realization you made?
Yes. Soon after the Army records were made, there was only three words that described these, and that was mound of rocks. But soon thereafter, people decided that it was actually some sort of monument or cairn that was designed to draw people's eyes to it, and that this probably over the years had been destroyed. It might be represented as a small scatter of rocks on the surface. And so that is also what I was looking for. And so when I actually went to the exact location where my research suggested it would be, I wasn't prepared for this giant 30-foot pile of rocks down in a ravine. Hmm. And so I was actually standing on it, scanning the horizon, looking for what the graves that I expected should be there. And I looked down at what I assumed was in a pile of rocks thrown by a farmer to clear a field, and I realized that it was a built structure, very, very complex, 4 feet high, 8 feet across, 12 feet wide, with a large protective apron around it, and with a sandstone tablet next to it that wasn't readable. But it was not what people were looking for. It was not where they were looking for it. So it was a bit of a surprise to everyone.
Now, how far off is this from the actual monument?
Well, there are three monuments. There's right. The attack site, which has been there for a long time. It's correct. There recently has been a monument to memorialize the men and boys where they were killed. It's about 2,000 feet from there, so it's quite a distance. I also found the mass grave for the women and children, and it's actually much closer to the monument that was recently put up. It's about 600 feet away.
And this is right by the highway, you've said.
The women and children's grave is immediately adjacent to the right-of-way fence. So tens of thousands of people have actually seen it every year, not knowing what it was. It's kind of odd.
So I guess we should point out, Everett Bassett, that this is information. This is a report that you're in the process of doing, and you'll go through the process that archaeologists do of getting it peer reviewed, all of those kinds of things. But you did feel a sense of urgency to at least present what you found so far to the descendants themselves of the massacre. Is that correct?
Yes, I believe the descendants have not had the correct amount of control over this story, over either the narration or the access to the sites. And I felt that it was important that they not hear about it through some dry archaeological journal, but that they know about it right away and that they can take steps to protect these locations.
The graves are they bigger than you expected, larger than you expected, Everett Bassett?
Yeah, I wasn't exactly sure what to expect, but I certainly didn't expect these enormous, they're really built sepulchers. And I think most people felt that a little pit was dug in the ground and then, maybe a small little, like a mining cairn, maybe 4 foot high or 5 foot high was built over it. And so these are very, very unique features for the West.
Now, I guess we should understand that this represents the bulk of the people, most of the people killed in this incident. I mean, more than something like 100 people haven't been accounted for before. We think then this is the rest of them. Is that right?
We think that's a possibility, and I think that's probably the assumption to make until proven otherwise. But the other thing to point out is that the correct monument at the attack site memorializes what was essentially a battle.
Yeah.
And these represent killing fields of a massacre where there was a certain amount of treachery involved. So it's a different sort of location. It resonates differently with the descendants of the victims, and also I think with the descendants of the perpetrators.
In what sense? What do you mean? What do you mean by that?
Well, Mountain Meadows was a horrific event, and there was a lot of discussion about from early on, and I'm sure Will Bagley will discuss this later, but that these were done entirely by Native Americans, mm-hmm. and then it changed to it was Native Americans and Mormons, and then it became Mormons with a few Native Americans. But however you look at it, these people were led away from the campsite under a flag of truce and then cut down. And that's a very different story than the traditional, Western story of brave pioneers, mm-hmm. with their wagon trains wound it up and having an honest battle with attacking Native Americans. This was whites killing whites on a massive scale, unseen in America until the Oklahoma city bombing.
Yeah. You described these as sepulchers and that some kind of care had been taken. Does that show something kind of ironic, some sort of that they were careful with these bodies? I mean, that they built these cairns or these rock monuments to them, yet they were the perpetrators. They were the people that committed this mass murder. That seems contradictory and interesting.
Well, no, actually, it wasn't the perpetrators that built this.
I see.
It was the army. They came 20 months later.
I see.
So these bodies were actually laying out on the ground or partially buried in a ravine, but exposed to the elements, being torn about by wolves. And the army came, and they were under orders to take care of these bodies. And the structures they built are fairly classic army structures. We see them throughout the Civil War, and they're basically large boulder enclosures, rectangles, with the bodies placed in them or perhaps under them, it's not clear at this point, and then filled in with rocks to basically form a large rectangular, I don't know if we want to call it a sepulcher or a tomb. I call it a tumulus, which is an archaeological term for any rock structure marking mass graves. But they are unique in the West, I believe. I've been working here a long time. I've never seen anything like them.
I wonder, as I understand it, this land where you found these graves, this is not owned by the Mormon Church. Is that right?
No, it's not. And it's not currently under protection as a National Historic Landmark, which is why there was a certain amount of urgency to let the descendants put in place preservation measures.
Do you think that this provides an opportunity, Everett Bassett, to provide a more proper monument, if I can put it that way?
I think it provides a situation that a wider range of stakeholders will be involved as it goes forward. That includes the descendants, the ranchers that live in Mountain Meadows, the LDS Church, state parks, national forest, and the people of Utah. And I think the descendants want all of those stakeholders to have a say in the preservation and the interpretation of these features.
At the meeting where you presented your report on Saturday, a representative from the LDS Church was there. What is the Mormon Church's reaction been to all of this so far?
I think they're excited. I think they are, like most professional historians, they want to look closely at my report and visit things in the field and make sure I'm right. They graciously acknowledge that that their interpretation of where the locations were may not have been quite right. So I think everything's moving along the way it should.
Let me ask you this finally, because one of the questions you apparently asked at that gathering there in Harrison, Arkansas, was, what do you want to do about it? To the descendants, what's the reaction, and what do you think is next?
Well, I think it's early days yet. I think that's a long, long track down the road. The major problems is that many people are going to want these undisturbed, in particular, the remains undisturbed. At the same time, they are under threat both from flash floods and from visitors, and they need to be somehow stabilized. So I think there's going to be some long-term negotiated solution to protect these.
That's Everett Bassett. He's a senior archaeologist with the consulting firm TransCon Environmental. Joined us by phone from California. Mr. Bassett, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
When we get back from a break, we'll talk to historians David Bigler and Will Bagley. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the historians David Bigler and Will Bagley. Bigler's just published a collection of essays and articles about Mormon history. These are some of the most sensitive subjects on the matter. Mountain Meadows, as we just talked about, the Mormon Reformation, the character of Brigham Young. He's joining us with his longtime collaborator, as I said, Will Bagley, talking about their approach to history and probably tell a few stories as well. David Bigler is an independent historian, former director of the Utah Board of State History, and friends of the University of Utah Libraries. He has a lot of books. They include Forgotten Kingdom, The Mormon Theocracy in the American West. That new collection I referred to is called Confessions of a Revisionist Historian. And we should say, speaking tonight at Ken Sanders Rare Books. We'll give you details about that as we go along. David Bigler, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Will Bagley is back with us. He edited this book by David Bigler, also an editor of the Kingdom of the West series, author of Blood of the Prophets, Brigham Young and the Massacre at Mountain Meadows. And Will Bagley, welcome back to you.
Glad to be here.
Well, I guess we have to begin with Mountain Meadows, with this news. Will Bagley, let me start with you. Your reaction to this finding, how significant is something like this?
It shook me to my boots, and I'd had a heads up that Everett was going to talk to the Mountain Meadows Monument Foundation.
Yeah.
Mountain Meadows commemorative politics is extremely complicated and contested. I have been thrown out of the Mountain Meadows Association, excommunicated in a way, and readmitted. And I have been invited by the Mountain Meadows descendants to speak to them. And they're all these people are great people. And they include descendants of John D. Lee. And it's been a remarkable movement. And David was present at the creation of this and was extremely influential in bringing people together. And we had Ron Loving and Vern Lee.
React to what the finding itself. This pile of rocks that he sits down on and figures, and he comes to this kind of epiphany that this is what it is. It's nearby, but it's not right where the monument was. And now he's trying to protect it. It's kind of an extraordinary story.
Oh, a lot of us have spent a lot of time looking for it,
really?
And I may have walked right by it. But what he described is an army mass burial.
Yeah.
And it is exactly the professionalism and the execution that the army did. They got the job done in the American West. Wasn't always pleasant. In this case, it wasn't. They collected all of the remains of the men and boys and put them in this enormous, large pit.
Yep.
And then they covered it over so that the wild animals wouldn't continue gnawing on them. They did the same thing for the women. There are extremely chilling stories. They didn't put all the bones of the women in those. They carried some of the tresses, the long hair of these women, and apparently a skull or two back to Camp Floyd. This whole story is so horrific. It is an example of human evil at work. And it is one of the most troubling features of it is done by deeply religious people. And I think David can speak to that better than I can.
What's your reaction to the news of something like this? You've been writing about this for decades now.
About Mountain Meadows?
Yeah.
Actually, I'm more concerned about the problem we face in the country today because we're in a sense of complacency over challenges to our country that are occurring in other parts of the world that can be identified with the latter half of the 19th century, similarities that come from Mormonism, from which we fail to learn and take lessons, but allowed historians to distort or rewrite the history. And along I come to get the story correct, because I think history requires accuracy, which means honesty, and in no other way does it serve us. We need to wake up and pay attention to it, not only Mormons, but go beyond that. So I'm the revisionist historian. I'm the reviser of what was revised in the beginning.
Yeah, right. Well, let's talk about that, because that's a term that's been used in not such a good way to describe you. You've, as I said earlier in an introduction, you've embraced that idea of being a revisionist. Where does it come from? Because, again, it's been used as a dig by others. He's revising. He's not getting it right, or he's changing the conventional idea that we know, I guess.
Well, it all started at a conference of the Mormon History Association a few years ago. And opening the meeting, the professor of history warned against the dangers of revisionists. And he pointed his finger at several, among whom he identified David Bigler as one of these. And I thought to myself, you know, I really am a revisionist. I'm revising what these guys have done, and to get where they've made mistakes or they've taken advantage of things for the church's benefit or some other, to get the story right. Because if there's one thing that drives me, it is a belief in history as being given to us by heaven above to learn from and not make the mistakes again and again.
One of the things that I think it's important to say this early on, where you are coming from. You were raised Mormon. You come from good Mormon stock. At some point, you left Mormonism and you became an evangelical Christian. How much of your leaving Mormonism was related to what you were discovering of the Mormon story, and how much of it was part of your just feeling concerned about the fact that the story wasn't being told in the right way, that the history was, you know, being falsified?
My interest in history goes back to the childhood. Mm-hmm. So it was not from anything, problems I had directly with the church. It was in using history as a vehicle for some other purpose, not related to actually the conditions you face in the world at the time. And as you go back and look at things that are said in the past, someone said, one of the leaders in our time said, what good fortune for the government is that people do not think. Well, how do you think clearly and positively if you don't have the accurate understanding of the event you're described talking about and what's going on?
But what you're one of the points—
Adolf Hitler said that.
Here's my point, because I want to get this out of the way. One of the things that you and Will Bagley have talked about, and a lot of historians have said, is, look, you have to understand the motivations of people of their time to be able to understand this. And if you're going to understand why history has been cleaned up, the warts burnished off, all of those kinds of things, is you have to understand people are invested deeply in all of this. My question to you before we move on is, how is it that you're not invested as an evangelical Christian against Mormonism? That's your point of view, is that you're somehow an anti-Mormon, or that you're looking to destroy the, you know, origin stories of Mormonism. I want to have you address that so we can move on.
Well, I just, as I grew up, never really took it seriously, to be honest with you. As I learned and understood it better, I realized the harm that had been actually done to a lot of people by misunderstandings in this area, such as Mountain Meadows Massacre. Now, that's not a typical example. It's an extremely one.
Yeah.
And out of that event came one man, John Hawley. And he was one of the Mormons in southern Utah who was asked to join the party and to do the attack on that wagon train. He refused to do it.
Right. He spoke out.
They said, if you don't do it, you'll be killed. He said, this is as good a time to die as any. Tell them at headquarters, I could be killed any time, and I'm ready to go at any time. Tell them I will not participate in this. And I stand on that ground and will not change from that ground. He was the only man who stood up and refused to take part. Now, today we're facing similar problems. We don't realize that. We think it's in the Middle East or somewhere else. But they're growing and they're going to be with us after my time and yours. And it's time to get the story straight, understand it, and to have the courage. You know, in the Bible, we think of the Bible as a source of information on conduct, personal conduct. Actually, the most frequent injunction in the Bible is be not afraid. What we need today is the courage to face up to the reality that exists. I intend to learn that reality and to get it on paper correctly and on stations like this. Now, the three best men I've known in my life, of the three, two of them are Mormons. One of them is my own father. So you can see I'm not out to harm Mormons or the church. I want to correct a history that has been rewritten and changed and needs to be brought back into the realm of the real world.
Will Bagley, let me get you on that subject. How far off is the story?
It depends.
You're trying to revise it. You guys are revising it. You're trying to get it right. How far off is it right now? Do you know? Can you tell?
Well, the first story was the Indians did it. And that story didn't hold – nobody outside of Utah much believed it. But it held up until at least 1869. And I think at that point the hierarchy got the word that one of the participants a former bishop named Klingensmith was going to spill the beans. But up till 1869, they have denied it in the newspapers. Then Philip Klingensmith did an affidavit that laid out the horrific details. At that point, they said, well, there were a few bad Mormons, but a whole lot of Indians, and the Indians made them do it. So they were getting closer to the truth, but you can't get close. You got to do your best to figure out what really happened. And what really happened was the Mormons in southern Utah gathered every loose freebooter that they could persuade to come help them loot a wagon train. And then they ran the show. They dressed up as Indians. They persuaded these people who trusted them to surrender, and then they brutally murdered them. That's the grim reality. And in terms of getting closer to that reality, we had the trials of John D. Lee, which were largely a show. But in 1950, we had Juanita Brooks write probably the most courageous volume of Utah history ever written, called The Mountain Meadows Massacre. It was a documentary history that just laid out the documents. David knew Juanita Brooks. We all, as historians, admire and worship her. Maybe not worship, but we hold her in very high regard. My reverence for David Bigler is equivalent to my respect for Juanita Brooks, because, as he pointed out, he has lots of Mormon friends and is highly regarded by them. And he is not your militant evangelical who's anti-Mormon. He's not anti-anything. He's one of the five true Christians I've ever met in my life. And he believes in practicing what Jesus taught. And there are way too few people who profess to be Christians who don't do that.
David Bigler, I want to ask you, there's this theme that Polly Aird, who wrote a foreword to your book, she has identified a kind of a meta theme, as she describes it, in your talks and in your articles. And that is this pursuit by early Mormons for divine sovereignty. Would you explain that? Would you talk a little bit about that?
Part of their belief and religious belief and belief generally in the world and in the United States at that time. And that was that the Lord is coming. He's coming soon. It's going to be maybe tomorrow or next week, but it won't be later than next month. They believed ideas and that people today don't take seriously. So that what we learn from them, we have to be very careful what we take from it.
This interesting we'll come back to Mountain Meadows as we go along, but I'm interested in a couple of these stories. One of them, the attack on Fort Limhi. Does this convey one of these ideas about the millennium, this idea that Christ was returning just around the corner? Is this another one of those examples of that?
It was part of the call of Indian missionaries that went out in 1855. Mormons at that time and still believe that Indians are descendants of the tribes of Israel, and they intended to get them on their side in an effort to build an independent theocratic state in the American West. And that was the drive, and that was the picture that was painted by historians and taken from that. Now, to me, Mountain Meadows means something today. That was then. We're talking about, we're rehashing stuff in the past. Well, Mountain Meadows to me today, it was illustrated 15 years ago when descendants of those who were killed restored to, carried to the monument, little boxes that they put the bones and so on of their relatives in and laid them at the base of the monument. They were escorted by Boy Scouts from Mormon settlements all around that area.
Yeah.
Now, that carries the message that Dave Bigler is interested in, a joining together now and understanding the past best and supporting each other in what's facing our country today. And if we want to pass it on to future generations, we'd better, by golly, be paying attention to the positive lessons that Mountain Meadows teaches us and not overlook them in however much deserved sympathy for those who lost their lives and the relatives that were descended from them.
Do you think that it seems like when you, if you want reconciliation, you want resolution, you want people to come together, which is what you saw 15 years ago, doesn't there have to be kind of an agreed acknowledgement of what actually happened? And it seems like on some significant points, there's still a difference of opinion. And Will Begley, let me get you to start on this. The big question, obviously, is what role Brigham Young may or may not have had in the ordering of the murders of those of that wagon train in 1857. You have a particular opinion on it, that how could Brigham Young not have been involved? He absolutely ruled with, you know, with an iron fist. He would have been involved in absolute. I mean, you didn't. I don't think you've presented any particular evidence on that point yet. And this is a dispute by the, or maybe you have. I'll give you a chance to do that. There's some dispute, obviously, within the LDS Church about whether or not Brigham Young was involved. But is there? That's a sticking point still in this. In this, if you're wanting to get a reconciliation, this is still a point. And how important is this point, do you think? Both of you, I want to hear you on that.
Well, it's become the central point in the controversy. But it in many ways, does it matter? Winita Brooks said, George.
Does it matter if Brigham Young ordered it? Does it matter? Are you saying that?
No. I'm saying that Winita Brooks, 65 years ago, the year I was born, said Brigham Young and George A. Smith, who was his helpmate, were responsible for the social conditions that made Mountain Meadows possible. Once you assign moral responsibility for an atrocity like this, everything else is inside baseball. But why am I – and people are going to believe whatever they want about anything, especially did Brigham Young order the massacre. Well, guess what? Brigham Young confessed, and he did it at Mountain Meadows. He did it in May of 1861, just as the United States was disintegrating. And he looked up at the Army's cairn, which had been built at the site of the wagon battle. And he read what the cross, a 14-foot cedar cross, said on its crosspiece. And it was, "Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. I shall repay." And he looked, he said, according to the Journal of Apostle Wilford Woodruff, it should say, "Vengeance is mine, and I have taken a little." And he didn't say, "Then the Lord has taken a little." He said, "I have taken a little." And I have maintained in my writings that this was an act of vengeance. And I believe that's – well, there's several smoking guns, but that's the one with the most smoke.
David Bigler, one of the things that you've talked about in terms of this story is that one of the morals is that it's the duty of leaders to use language with moderation and self-discipline. that this was part of the problem. This was what Will was alluding to there a moment ago, that it was a powder keg, volatile situation, and leaders didn't make matters better. They made them worse. Would you talk to that point?
Well, I think that was the kind of thinking that was part of what was called the Reformation, which was an important aspect of the conflict that Mormons had with the United States at that time. And this was that the people of God had failed to measure up to the requirements for God or the Lord to support them in taking an independent position, and they needed to prepare for that work to be done by the Reformation. And the Reformation was a very scary people to think to a lot of people, and it's a big subject in itself that leads to distortion when it's just covered by a few sentences and in a meeting like this. But it frightened the daylights out of a whole lot of people, and it was eventually recalled. But people then were threatened with things as serious as blood atonement, where there were some sins that were so serious that they had to be atoned by the sinner shedding their own blood.
A lot of these sort of forgotten doctrines and ideas, you two have written about the Reformation being one of them, blood atonement another one. You've spent some time really exploring that. Will Bagley, let me come back to you on this. Richard Turley, an assistant church historian, the church has written a book about their take about what had happened at the massacre at Mountain Meadows. And what Turley has said, and I know you know this, but so I want to give you a chance to respond. He says that the people in Cedar City really did want to do something about this wagon train, that there was, you know, but that Brigham Young, his answer came too late. He said, you must not meddle with them. And in fact, Brigham Young was trying to keep them from keep this powder keg from going off. That's the LDS's position on this right now. You want to respond to that? David, yeah, go for it.
You can stay on Mountain Meadows until you know what freezes over, and you're not going to get any really honest picture of it in the end. And what I'm saying today is that was then, this is now. Understand it was a different time, and it's time to move forward now. And the way to start is to learn from the history of that period, join together, and preserve the freedom that we enjoy in this country against similar things, challenges, threats that are taking places in other parts of the world.
Well, I'll answer the question.
Yeah, wait. Wait, David Bigler, I don't understand. So it seems like one thing you're saying is I want to be an honest historian. I want to tell the truth. I want to be brave. And it seems like what you're saying is – I don't get what you're saying, because it seems like what you're saying is does it – don't you have to address that question of whether Brigham Young was involved? I mean, or are you reluctant to because you want to get to resolution? Yet you're also an historian who wants to deal with the truth of the past. So
Never going to get a really – conclusive answer to that question. You can spend forever chewing it, but chewing it doesn't do a thing for what we face today.
What do you mean by that? What do we face today? What are you talking about? I don't understand that.
Well, I think we have a country called Iran that we've given away the right to build nuclear weapons and the means to distribute them. They refer to this country constantly in terms of their purposes to destroy Israel and the United States. Constantly. And in my opinion, these guys are the extremists of our time. They belong in the 19th century, not in our time. But they're dangerous because of what they can do. And we better face up to that. We take a lot of comfort in being in this country and all the things it does for us. But we're threatened today, and we better wake up, wake up, wake up. So what's going on?
Will Bagley, do you have arguments with David Bigler over politics and Iran, for example? Where are you on this score? He seems to be coming at it from, I'm worried about Islamic fascists.
Well, there's a big question of, do people learn from history? It would be nice if they did, but it's hard to find evidence they do. I accepted a spur from the Western Writers of America, which is a high honor. I said, David Bigler and I disagree about virtually everything except history. We disagree about religion. He's a devout Christian. I'm a militant agnostic. He thinks that Barack Obama is a socialist. I'm a socialist. And let me tell you, Barack Obama is no socialist. And it got a big laugh from a very conservative group. But the bottom line is, the conservatives' problem is they don't have anything to offer. What's the alternative to getting Iran to shut down their plutonium reactors and put it off? These are all modern controversies, but I don't think that either David Bigler or Will Bagley is going to resolve it. But honesty about Mountain Meadows and accepting the fact that that horror that took place on that field 158 years ago had immense moral consequences, and they still echo today.
David, yeah.
We've seen some horror in our own time, haven't we?
Yeah.
Haven't we seen people with their heads cut off? Haven't we seen people put in cages and burned to death? Aren't we looking at the same kinds of things in our time that existed then? We're saying somehow we're different today. People are different.
So what you're saying is we need history to keep us...
Absolutely.
Right. Give us perspective.
You're right.
Okay.
And I think David's take on how to react to religious fanatics, political fanatics, is very accurate. He says, scotch them when you can. Don't let them acquire power and get more powerful. Come down on them. And the United States has had mixed results in attempting to do that. But I wish people did learn more from history.
Will Bagley is with us. He edited David Bigler's new book, which is called Confessions of a Revisionist Historian. David Bigler, an independent historian, former director of the Utah Board of State History. He's going to be speaking tonight at Ken Sanders Rare Books. There's details about that on our website, radiowest.org. We need to take a break, and we'll come back for some final thoughts in just a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us two historians, David Bigler, one of them, Will Bagley, the other. Bigler's just published a collection of essays and articles from his life as an independent historian over the years. It's called Confessions of a Revisionist Historian. He's speaking tonight at Ken Sanders Rare Books in Salt Lake City. We have details about that on our website, radiowest.org. So I want to ask you about one of the articles you write about, and this is something that I'm not sure how much time we have for, but the Aiken Party murders. We hear a lot about Mountain Meadows. The scale of this was somewhat smaller, obviously, but I'm wondering, what's the story here? Will Bagley tell us? Just get us a sense of this story, because it's something that's in the book.
It's an example of the criminal conduct of Utah's leaders during the Utah War. It was the murder of five Californians who had a considerable amount of money. And as it also is related to the event that brought David Bigler's to an interest in Utah's history, which was when Hal Schindler, more than 50 years ago, I guess, asked if Dave was related to Jake Bigler. And David didn't recognize he was a reference to Jacob Bigler, his great-great-great-grandfather. And Hal Schindler yelled in Hal's inimitable way across the restaurant, "Jake Bigler engineered the Aiken murders." But it was murder for hire. And it's either Jake or another person who testified at the trials said that they – because it was so botched. It involved Porter Rockwell, eventually Bill Hickman. And it was a complete botch. Two guys stagger into town covered in blood the next morning. And because it's such a fiasco, somebody in Nephi says, "Oh, no, the old boss won't give us any more jobs." And guess who the old boss was? But David, in Hal was a romantic historian. He was a dear friend, but he was also a very straight Mormon historian. He was very Mormon. And it helps a lot to be brought up in this culture to be able to write about it.
That's kind of where I wanted to head. Oh, go ahead, David.
I wanted to add.
Please.
The three best men I've known in my life, two of them were Mormon.
You mentioned that before, right?
I wanted to do it again.
Okay.
Do it again were Mormons. One was my own father, one of the most honest men I've known. The other was a state one of the three.
First presidency.
Members of the church's first presidency in Eldon Tanner, who's now passed on.
Yeah.
So don't classify me as anti-Mormon.
And this is something that we could probably spend an hour talking about. Do you think, David Bigler, I'll start with you on this question. Can an active Latter-day Saint be truthful about Mormon history when they have a lot to invest, when some of the warts of history emerge and it plays counter to their ideals, their vision for their church? I mean, is that a problem?
I think you keep your ideals under control so that they don't prompt people who don't have your control from going out of proper conduct. So the answer to that is it's all up individually, and my answer to that is we'll know someday, and in the meantime, we have God's word to go by, and if we stick to that in our daily work, in our relations with others, and with our families and what we teach them, we don't have to worry about all these other things that seem so compelling at any particular time.
What do you think about that question? Do you feel skeptical that, I mean, active Latter-day Saints are very invested in this story.
Mm-hmm.
And can they properly tell the story because they're so invested?
Well, Anita Brooks did. And she brought that focus of honesty and let the evidence show what it shows. I have very, very dear friends, many of them who work for the LDS Church, who've been extremely helpful in my work. And in some ways, the question – I could easily take the question as a personal insult. But I'd ask the same question. Can a total unbeliever write fairly about the role of religion in the history of the overland immigration? Well, I sure hope so. I've already got a draft of a chapter on religion on the trails. And I begin it by saying religion – faith cannot move mountains, but faith moves people. And the role of religion on the Overland Trail was immense. A lot of people left God the Missouri, but a lot of – especially women who'd lost their children and husbands, they found consolation. And that has been the salve that makes it impossible to dismiss religion and its positive impacts on people's lives. But I've got a final quote from David Bigler. David gave this presentation at OCTA 10 years ago. Just about.
He gave it where?
At the Oregon California Trails Association. Okay. And it was a big, successful convention, and there were all kinds of people. Richard Turley was in the audience. And at the end of his talk, there was a dead silence. And then people erupted into applause. And this is close to the ending. He talks about how the book on Mountain Meadows was finally closed when they shot John D. Lee. Except for the bones. The bones cried from the ground in 1859 when Major Carleton buried many from the victims of all ages and erected over them a monument of stones and a cross. The monument was later torn down, but the bones would not keep silent. The men of Company M, 2nd California Cavalry, heard them and restored it. The bones again cried from the ground in 1999, when the LDS Church, in cooperation with the descendants of John D. Lee and family members of the immigrants, began work on a new memorial. A backhoe operator broke the ground and exposed the bones buried by Carleton's men. A young woman's skull with a bullet hole in the crown, broken children's bones, arms and leg bones scarred by coyote teeth. A self-disciplined county sheriff saw the children's bones and was deeply moved. That was what really hit me hard. And now we've got a new... We have some good science now. And I believe that those bones make it inevitable that Mountain Meadows will be a national monument.
Will Bagley and David Bigler, an independent historian. His book is Confessions of a Revisionist Historian. He's speaking tonight at Ken Sanders Rare Books. Go to our website for the particulars, radiowest.org. Gentlemen, thank you for the time. Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.